So, if you ask an AI to write an article right now, you basically get a robot.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
It's just so stiff.
Yeah, it's like this overly polite translation ease. It feels like it was written by a committee of bureaucrats just trying not to offend anyone.
Right, completely soulless.
Exactly. But what if you could systematically extract the invisible DNA of your favorite writer? Like mathematically map out their exact stylistic quirks.
And then use an AI to just perfectly replicate their soul on the page.
Yes. So that is the mission for our deep dive today. We're pulling this from a really fascinating source article titled How to Steal a Writing Style from Any Author.
Which is actually part two in a much broader series.
Hmm.
The whole series is focused on teaching AI to write natively in Chinese, specifically to bypass that awful translation ease we were just talking about.
Right. And the author lays out an actual four-step style heist to capture literally anyone's voice.
Yeah, it completely reframes how we look at creativity. Because,
Mm-hmm.
you know, we've spent centuries treating an author's voice as this intangible magic.
Like just vibes, basically.
Exactly. Vibes or intuition. But the source material argues that a writing style isn't magic at all. It's a highly structured, totally reverse-engineerable operating system.
Okay, before we get to the actual heist part, we need to talk about why this is even necessary. Because the author ran this very logical experiment first, and it failed in such a spectacular
Well,
way.
the style guide experiment. Yeah, that's highly illustrative.
Excellent.
So they spent an entire week manually building this massive 435-line style guide.
435 lines. Wow.
Right, and the sole goal was to make the AI output read like natural native Chinese. And for general text, I mean, this guide was a massive success. The AI sounded incredibly fluid.
But the problem started when they tried to push the boundaries, right? They took that exact same glowing prompt and asked the AI to write a tech and product review.
Yeah, and the result was beautifully written, but for a tech review, a complete disaster.
Because it sounded exactly like Bamfo.
Yes. For context, Banfo is this wildly popular Chinese essayist. He's known for top-tier, really heavy-hitting social commentary.
So instead of getting a clean breakdown of like a new tech product's features, the AI spit out this highly immersive scene.
Yep, it employed a complex three-layer spiral narrative.
And it ended with a profound philosophical punchline, which is just, I'm gonna pause on that term for a second, a three-layer spiral
It's
narrative.
intense.
Yeah. If I'm looking for a tech review, I just want to know if the battery lasts, right? And if the screen is bright. I don't want a spiral narrative.
Right.
What is the AI actually doing structurally when it uses that?
Well, in a spiral narrative, you don't just state a fact and move on. You introduce a surface-level event, so say a flaw in the product.
Okay.
Then the narrative spirals down a layer
Right.
into like the psychological reaction to that flaw.
Oh, wow.
Then it spirals down again into the societal or economic realities that actually caused the company to make that flawed product in the first place.
Jeez. So you're drilling down to the philosophical bedrock of a simple tech gadget.
Exactly. Which is brilliant for social commentary, but, you know, maddening if you just want to buy a laptop.
Huh, totally. I mean, it completely exposes the core fallacy of prompt engineering right now. Like, we constantly try to fix AI writing by just adding a modifier.
Oh, like make it more casual.
Right, or adjust the tone. But trying to turn a philosophical essayist into a snappy tech blogger by just asking for a different tone, it's like wearing a tailored tuxedo to a casual tech startup meetup.
The outfit is objectively great.
Yeah, but the context is completely wrong. Or like using the physics engine of a racing game to run a chess simulator. The underlying rules of reality are completely mismatched.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And the source outlines this by breaking the writing landscape into six fundamentally different domains.
Right, the six domains,
So
though.
you have the essay and commentary domain, which we just saw with Banfo, that's heavy on emotional anchors and spiraling narratives. But then you have the business analysis domain.
And if you try to run an essayist's physics engine in business analysis, it completely fails.
Because business analysis requires data gravity. It needs that let's do the math approach with incredibly bold, definitive verdicts.
And the other domains are just as distinct, right? Like personal essays, they thrive on subjective experience and warmth.
While career and productivity writing requires rigid frameworks, you need actionable steps and, like, zero fluff.
Story and resonance writing relies entirely on dramatic turns and pacing. And then AI or tech writing requires this mix of casual expertise, internet memes, and a specific wow factor.
Right. And the key takeaway here is that every single one of those six domains has completely different paragraph rhythms.
They have different emotional arcs.
And most crucially, different taboo lists.
Yeah.
You simply cannot use a one-size-fits-all style guide. You have to map a new operating system from scratch, depending on the domain.
Which brings us directly to the four-step systematic method, because, you know, intuition just isn't scalable. The author outlines an actual engineering process to steal a style.
The heist.
Yes, the heist. Step one is to collect the corpus. You're supposed to find 10 to 20 of your target author's viral hit articles.
The ones with the absolute highest engagement. The most shares, the undeniable blockbusters of their catalog.
Okay, wait, I have a major issue with this. Viral hits are inherently optimized for an algorithm, right?
Sure.
If you only feed the AI an author's most viral pieces, you aren't actually capturing their best writing. You're capturing their most clickbaity writing. You're training an attention merchant, not an artist.
Well, it's a completely rational concern. But the source actually provides a really counterintuitive defense here.
Okay, let's hear it.
A viral article is actually the purest expression of that specific author's stylistic mechanics working flawlessly.
How so?
The audience is basically democratically voting on the delivery mechanism.
But algorithms reward high arousal emotions, you know? Shock, anger, surprise. Aren't we just stripping out all the nuanced, quiet pieces the author wrote?
Not necessarily. If the author's primary style relies on quiet nuance, their version of a viral hit within their specific community is going to reflect the best execution of that quiet nuance.
Oh, I see.
We aren't comparing their engagement to a tabloid. We're looking at their personal baseline. The viral hits are the moments where the author's unique paragraph rhythm, their specific vocabulary, and their pacing resonated most perfectly with their readership.
So it's like their operating system running at peak efficiency without any dropped frames.
Exactly.
Okay, viewing it as the delivery mechanism firing on all cylinders, that makes sense. So we have our corpus of 20 viral hits. Step two is to dissect the patterns.
And the author gives us five structural questions to ask here. We aren't looking at the topic of the articles at all.
Right. We are strictly looking at the blueprints.
Question one. How do they open? Are we getting a declarative statement, a question, a personal anecdote?
Right. And question two, what is the paragraph rhythm? Are we dealing with dense blocks of text or like single sentence rapid fire?
Then there's question three, and the source highlights this as the absolute most critical piece of the puzzle.
The taboos.
Yes. What words do they never use? What sentence patterns are completely absent from the text? We'll get into why this is the firewall of an operating system in a minute, but the idea of a taboo list defining a writer is fascinating.
It really is. Like, you are defined by what you refuse to do.
Exactly. Question four examines the punchlines. Where do they place their heaviest emotional or intellectual hits?
And finally, question five maps the emotional arc. Does the piece start cold and analytical and slowly become enraged? Or does it start frantic and end with a calm, philosophical takeaway?
Once you have all that, you take those observations into step three, cross-validate. And the rule here is incredibly strict.
Yeah, pattern must appear in at least three different articles before it can be considered part of the author's DNA.
Right. If an author uses a specific weird metaphor in one viral article, but never again, you just discard it. It's a one-off.
It's not structural.
Exactly. This prevents the AI from over-indexing on a topic-specific quirk. You're panning for the goal that consistently appears in the river, regardless of the water level.
I like that. Which leads to step four, structure the output. You have to compile all of these validated insights into a standardized style profile.
And this isn't just a Word document full of qualitative notes like, write punchy and be funny.
Right. The source specifies this must be machine readable. But how does a vibe actually become machine readable?
Well, you have to translate qualitative observations into quantitative constraints for the large language model.
So numbers.
Yes. Instead of saying be punchy, the style profile literally dictates a parameter like maximum tokens per sentence, 20.
Oh, wow.
And instead of saying sound casual, it provides a JSON array of specific colloquialisms the author uses alongside negative prompt weights for academic jargon.
You are building a literal fence around the AI's probabilistic word choices.
Exactly.
To prove this structural mapping actually holds up in reality, the source material puts two massive writers head to head. They map the operating systems of Banfo, the heavy-hitting social commentator we talked about,
right,
and Kazike, who is a top-tier AI and tech blogger.
In contrasting these two, really eliminates how drastically different these parameters need to be. Let's look at question one, the openings.
Okay.
Banfo, writing in the essay domain, relies entirely on cognitive dissonance. The source cites an example where he might open an article with, Mibok leaking water is actually reasonable.
It's such a jarring statement. Your brain immediately rejects it, which forces you to read the next sentence just to see how he could possibly justify it.
Right. But Kazike, operating in the tech domain, uses a completely different mechanism. His openings are universally personal. He always starts with an I.
Like what?
The source notes an opening like, I've been slacking off the past couple days because I finally finished Stranger Things season 5.
Ah, okay. So he grounds the reader in a shared mundane reality before he introduces a complex technological shift. He establishes himself as your peer.
Exactly. And his divergence shows up in the paragraph rhythm too. They both technically use short paragraphs, but for entirely different purposes.
Right. The source describes Banfo's paragraphs as violent slaps. They are these hard, rapid-fire assertions that just pummel the reader into agreement.
Whereas Kazike's short paragraphs are described as spacious and breathing.
Mm-hmm.
He has a strict, machine-readable rule for his operating system. He rarely exceeds 2 sentences, and he never exceeds 100 characters per paragraph.
Never exceeds 100 characters.
Never.
That is so specific. But there's a mechanical reason for that white space, isn't there?
Oh, definitely.
Like, if you're explaining how a new AI agent processes data, the reader's working memory needs a second to digest that. The white space gives the concept room to settle.
Yeah. If Banfo tried to explain an AI agent using violent slaps of text, the reader would be exhausted by paragraph 3.
Totally. And the punchlines are equally distinct. Banfo places his at the end of a long narrative buildup. The source calls his punchlines the ultimate conclusion of an interest analysis.
Right.
What does an interest analysis actually look like in this context?
It's the reveal of who fundamentally profits from the situation. After spiraling through the social commentary, Banfo's punchline strips away the illusions and points directly at the hidden financial or power dynamics.
It's an intellectual hammer.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Kazike, conversely, uses punchlines for what the author calls emotional crystallization.
I love that phrase, emotional crystallization. Kazike delivers these highly compressed, screenshot-worthy sentences that take a massive, intimidating text shift and reduce it to a pure human feeling.
They really stick with you. The text highlights a few, like the feeling of being alive that's the most expensive luxury in the AI era.
Oh.
Or this chilling single-sentence paragraph wrapping up an article about automation. Behind him, no one.
Wow. And to deliver those emotional crystallizations, Kazike utilizes very specific colloquial language, right?
Yeah, he drops phrases like holy crap, or he organically mixes in English tech terminology like demo or agent. He speaks the exact dialect of a highly engaged tech enthusiast.
It creates this incredibly precise persona. Like, Banfo is the intense late-night comedian delivering a slightly edgy, aggressive monologue.
Uh-huh.
But Kazike is your brilliantly geeky friend sitting across from you at a coffee shop. Kazike is casual, but he never crosses into the profanity or the oily smarminess that a pure shock jock might use.
Which brings us right back to the most critical part of step two, the taboo list, the things these writers just refuse to do.
Right.
Kazike's taboo list acts as the absolute firewall for his operating system.
His never do this parameters, what are they?
Well, he never reviews a tool he hasn't personally tested.
Okay.
He never uses untranslated academic jargon. If he introduces a complex term, the immediate next sentence simplifies it.
Right.
And most importantly, he never pretends to be objective. He is highly opinionated and always writes in the first person.
The source points out a really fascinating quirk about AI architecture here. If you don't explicitly enforce Kazike's taboo list-like, if your prompt doesn't actively ban fake objectivity in academic language, the AI will instantly destroy the Kazike style.
Because an AI model, specifically an LLM, is fundamentally trained on a vast corpus of human knowledge to be a helpful, neutral assistant.
Right.
Its baseline probability leans heavily toward balanced academic objective summaries. So if you don't apply negative prompt weights to suppress that default behavior, the AI will slowly regress back to the mean.
It just starts sounding like Wikipedia again.
Exactly. So you have to explicitly tell it, do not be helpful and objective. Be opinionated and biased.
Which transitions us into the hardest part of this entire deep dive. Everything we just discussed, paragraph length, openings, taboos, you can technically see those on the page. But the source argues the true mastery of a style heist lies in capturing the invisible DNA.
The structural choices that the reader absorbs completely subconsciously.
Right.
Formatting is a prime example.
Okay.
Kazeke almost never uses subheadings. You won't see section one or conclusion in his essays.
Interesting.
He relies entirely on narrative scene transitions and single sentence bridges to maintain a continuous flow. Banfo is even more extreme. His formatting is deliberately anti-aesthetic.
Anti-aesthetic. What does that mean?
It is pure text with zero images to break up the visual assault. Just a wall of words.
Wow. But wait, why does it matter if the AI hallucinates a subheading? If the writing itself is good, does a bolded section two really break the spell?
It shatters the operating system. Because LLMs are trained on highly structured web data and textbooks, they naturally want to organize information with bullet points and subheadings.
Oh.
If you don't map Kazeke's invisible DNA and explicitly forbid subheadings, the AI will automatically generate them.
Right.
And while a reader might not consciously think, oh, Kazeke never uses subheadings, their brain has internalized his visual rhythm over years of reading his stuff.
So if an AI inserts a bolded header, the reader experiences a sudden jarring disconnect.
Yeah. It feels like a corporate memo suddenly hijacked their friend's blog.
It's the uncanny valley of writing. You just sense something is off.
Exactly.
The text also highlights a brilliant linguistic example of this invisible DNA. They look at the Chinese phrase, yihe, which translates roughly to put it bluntly.
This part blew my mind.
Right, because it shows how AI processes language probabilistically.
It's a perfect demonstration of semantic mapping. So in Banfo's operating system, when he types the phrase, to put it bluntly, it acts as a structural hinge.
Like a pivot.
Exactly.
Hmm.
It almost universally signals that he is about to drop the interest analysis we talked about earlier. He is about to pivot the essay into a harsh breakdown of money or hidden motives.
But when Kizier uses the exact same phrase, to put it bluntly, it serves a completely different rhetorical function.
Right.
For Kazeke, that phrase is the signal that he is about to execute his taboo rule, translating a dense technological concept into a plain English analogy.
Same phrase, entirely different rhetorical purpose. You cannot simply tell an AI, hey, use the phrase, to put it bluntly, a few times to sound casual.
Because to the AI, words are just tokens mapped in a vector space. If you just tell it to use the phrase, it'll just insert it randomly.
Exactly. To actually steal the style profile has to map the rhetorical trigger. The AI must understand why that phrase is deployed in that specific author's DNA.
The level of granular engineering required here is just staggering, which forces the obvious question regarding scalability. I mean, the author openly admits in the source that executing this four-step heist manually takes them 2 to 3 solid days for a single writer.
And that's just for one author in one of the 6 domains.
Right. Collecting the corpus, mapping the vectors of a phrase, calculating the paragraph characters.
If you want a library of styles, a manual process would take months of full-time, tedious labor. It's a great theoretical framework, but practically useless for the average user right now.
But the text doesn't end there. It teases a part 3 to this series, introducing a solution they call copy style mode.
Yes, and this is where the deep dive moves from a neat experiment into a fundamental shift in how we might all work. Because the extraction process itself can be entirely automated by the AI.
The LLM can act as the structural engineer.
Exactly. Very soon, you won't need to spend 3 days dissecting punchlines yourself. You will be able to upload a single, highly effective reference document, and the AI will execute the four-step heist in real time.
In real time.
Yeah. It will calculate the token length of the paragraphs, identify the taboo words, map the emotional arc, and instantly build the machine-readable style profile in the background.
Just think about the practical application of that for you as a listener. Like, say you have to write a dry, highly technical update for your company.
Not the worst.
Right. But you take the single most engaging, widely read newsletter your CEO ever sent out, and you feed it into the copy style mode.
Oh, wow.
And in seconds, the AI extracts that exact DNA and rewrites your technical update using the CEO's precise paragraph rhythm and rhetorical hinges.
The author provides a brilliant metaphor to encapsulate why this is so revolutionary. Relying on pre-built generic style guides, like asking an AI to write in the style of Hemingway, it's like eating a frozen dinner.
It's static.
Exactly. It's a static, mass-produced imitation. But copy style mode, where the AI dynamically extracts the invisible DNA of any text you give it in real time, is like cooking from scratch.
It's dynamically generating the recipe based on the specific ingredients right in front of it.
Yeah.
So what we've ultimately uncovered in the source material is that human voice is measurable. It isn't magic.
No, not at all.
It is a quantifiable intersection of taboo lists, white space, and rhetorical triggers. We have basically built the diagnostic tool to map the soul of communication.
We really have. And as we consider a future where copy style mode is instantly accessible to everyone, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Okay, let's hear it.
If an AI can flawlessly auto-extract and wear the invisible DNA of any human writer in seconds, how do human writers prove they are still human?
Oh, wow. Because if the AI perfectly maps your operating system, running your own operating system suddenly makes you look like an AI.
Exactly. Will we reach a point where the only way an author can prove their humanity is by constantly, deliberately abandoning their own DNA?
That is wild.
Right. Will we be forced into a perpetual cycle of inventing bizarre, rule-breaking writing styles just to stay one step ahead of the machines that are constantly trying to perfectly imitate us? We might have to continually break our own rules just to prove we are the ones writing them.
Man, we finally figured out how to mathematically map the exact structural rules of human creativity, and the ultimate consequence might be that humans are no longer allowed to follow them. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the source material. We will catch you next time.